Hello and welcome to Undivided. Happy Friday. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, remember, we do an episode like this every single Wednesday that's exclusive to subscribers. You can access it by becoming a paid subscriber on Patreon, patreon.com/undivided, or by becoming a contributor at my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. It costs as little as $5 a month. I think it's a pretty good deal. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Coming up today, in just a moment, I'm going to talk about this new Candace Owens documentary on Black Lives Matter and where some of the money from that movement has gone. Also, Governor Jay Inslee rated the worst governor in the country, F grade, when it comes to fiscal responsibility, which will surprise approximately no one in Washington State. We'll tell you about how his ranking got so low. Also coming up on Fridays with Friends, legendary Seattle radio host Dave Ross joins us. We're going to have a discussion, maybe even a little bit of a debate about the crime crisis and his assertion that the November election is putting maybe an unfair spotlight on the crime crisis, whereas I believe it's putting a necessary spotlight on the crime crisis. So we'll have that conversation. Also, we may have a special guest in studio today for Florida Report. You'll have to stick around and find out. But first, as I said, I want to talk about this new Candace Owens documentary. You know, the Daily Wire is putting out some really interesting content. Of course, they had the Matt Walsh documentary about what is a woman. So I started last night watching the Candace Owens documentary, which is about Black Lives Matter. It's called The Greatest Lie Ever Sold. And it dives into, you know, whether people took advantage of the death of George Floyd to profit, you know, at the expense of sort of this movement. So first I want to note, I haven't finished watching it. I'm about a half hour in, but I thought I'd start talking about it today so that if you're interested, you could go watch it. And then on Monday, we can have another conversation about it and sort of get your guys' feedback on the documentary. I'll start by saying, look, I know Candace Owens is controversial. I realize that. Do I agree with everything she says? No. Let me just first, I'm going to play the trailer for this documentary, and then I'm going to give you my initial thoughts on the first half hour that I've watched.
Black Lives Matter released their 990 IRS filings. They collected $80 million.
Where is that money?
It's not here. Everything looks worse than it was.
Where have you seen that money impacted throughout the city? So my producer just sent me a link. It is just shocking to me because of how much money was raised to think that where he lived, the bills weren't being covered. Super frustrating, but that's a dead end, so. And here's where it gets really interesting. Ready for some BLM pride? Another $200K went to escorts, BDSM workers, strippers, peep show workers, phone sex operators, and webcam performers. And then at that moment, it became personal. And I thought, not only am I going to say the truth, I am going to scream the truth louder than you can scream the lies. It's incredible that the majority of the world hasn't seen this.
So a couple things. Candace Owens is not the first person to raise alarm bells about BLM spending and where some of those donations have gone. And in fact, in just the last week, you know, Kanye West called BLM a scam. But Sharon Osbourne donated, she said that she wants a refund for the $900,000 she donated to Black Lives Matter because she believes that it was a scam as well. She said she wants her money back. And, you know, there has been conversations about the founder of Black Lives Matter, who spent millions of dollars on real estate and some of these mansions, like just to have parties in. And BLM has gotten very defensive about any questions or concerns that people have about how the money has been spent. So I think that it's a mainstream opinion at this point to think that BLM, you know, raised money off the back of George Floyd's death to enrich itself and its founders. But anyway, so on Candace Owens, I think there was some misperceptions going into this that even I had about Candace Owens and her view on George Floyd and everything that happened. And part of the documentary opens by playing some initial thoughts she had immediately in the aftermath of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. And she doesn't believe that George Floyd deserved to die. I mean, she's questioned whether he should have just complied, but she said from the onset that she thought that, and she hoped that his family got justice in his death. And so she's not someone who's out there saying, oh yeah, he deserved to die for what he did, but she just refused at the beginning to have him be this sort of painted as a martyr for Black America, like someone who should be looked at as a heroic figure where children should be wearing t-shirts with his face on it and statues erected in his honor because of his criminal history. She just didn't think he was a good guy. So she didn't believe he deserved to die, but she didn't think that he deserved to be elevated to the status that he was elevated to. And so that's something that she kind of set straight right at the beginning of the documentary. But one of the things I will say in the first half hour that I really appreciated, and I already know how like BLM and folks are going to spin this, who aren't going to watch it, by the way. I think there's a lot of detractors of Candace Owens who aren't going to watch it but are going to opine on the documentary. And one of the things, the criticisms I can already see is that she paints George Floyd as this terrible guy and paints Derek Chauvin as a saint. It is true that Candace Owens in the first half hour spends a lot of time trying to make sure the audience gets to know George Floyd and Derek Chauvin. But what I see her doing is trying to ensure that the audience gets a complete picture of them, that she's filling in the pieces of their lives that the mainstream media left out. So the mainstream media ignored to large extent George Floyd's past criminal behavior, his past interactions with police. And the media really vilified to large extent Derek Chauvin. And again, I think Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. There's no question in my mind that George Floyd should not have died that day. But what I see Candace Owens doing is painting a complete picture and an accurate picture of these men. She sits down with the roommates, the two people who George Floyd lived with before he was killed. And, you know, she has a nice conversation with them and lets these people talk about their good memories of George Floyd and, you know, what kind of person he was from a very honest perspective. And then she does get into his criminal history and his past, and she does question them on why he didn't just comply. And so the picture I feel like she paints of George Floyd, yes, some people could say, well, she's vilifying the victim in this case. No, she's just giving a complete picture of who he was as an individual. And then you see her also fill in the pieces when it comes to Derek Chauvin. So what we know of Derek Chauvin is this, you know, cop and the images of him suffocating the life out of George Floyd. But Candace Owen takes time to show pictures, you know, I've never seen of Derek Chauvin, to tell stories about how he was a caretaker for his mom. And it doesn't change my opinion of what happened. But in the first half hour of this, I come away feeling like for the first time, I have a better understanding of who these two men were as a whole, who they were outside of that singular moment in time, those minutes that we watch unfold on that video. And I, for one, as kind of an independent thinker, I really appreciated that approach in the first half hour. I don't think she's coming in at the beginning of this documentary. And again, I've got about 45 minutes left of it to watch. I don't see it as being incredibly controversial thus far. I just see it as her doing the job that the media failed to do for so many years in painting a complete picture of these men. So I like it so far. And I know where she's going with it. She's going to look into the money and where the money has gone. And shouldn't everybody be in favor of that? If you gave money like Sharon Osbourne, $900,000 to BLM, or if you're a hardworking American who gave $50, and that's a lot of money to you, to BLM, don't you want to make sure that it went to actually benefit Black lives in this country, be it Black businesses or criminal justice reform causes or what have you? It's like I use the same analogy for the homelessness crisis in the Seattle area. You know, we have thrown hundreds of millions of dollars at that. And to me, there's almost this like this sentiment that, oh, if you demand accountability for that money, then you hate the homeless. No, I demand accountability for that money because I want the homeless to actually get help. If there's $100 million to help the homeless, I want to make sure that every dime of that goes to helping the homeless. So everyone should want accountability for funds, or in this case, for donations. And so I'll read, BLM proactively came out to offer a, because they knew this documentary was coming. So I'll read a little bit of what they said. I mean, they went on this like multi-tweet thing. I'm not gonna read it all. They said, today or someday soon, Candace Owens will release a purported documentary, they put in quotes, that will attempt to further divide Black people and uplift white supremacy. Okay. From what we've seen, we know there will be lies, hateful speech, racism, homophobia, and or transphobia embedded in her work, which BLM GNF does not condone. What is GNF? Okay, I'll look in that. I don't know what that is. Just one second. As a community, we are experiencing an attack on Black freedom fighting, which is part of a centuries-long machine meant to terrorize and dismantle Black liberation. We must push back against any false information regarding the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. Okay, that's what that meant. With clear, accessible data. And then they get into their own, they put a link to BLM Transparency Center. And that's fine. They have every right in the world to try to counter the documentary with what they say are their own facts. But it says, so for instance, they talk about their fundraising. The IRS Form 990 also reports that BLM GNF distributed more than 33% of the total dollars raised, which means over $25 million in grants and other assistance have been given to approximately 50 different Black-led organizations. So $25 million to 50 different Black-led organizations accounting for 33% of total dollars raised. And they're tweeting that. That doesn't seem like something to brag about. As reported in the most recent filed IRS Form 990, less than 10% of BLM's budget was used for operating costs, which demonstrates the foundation's efficiency. Okay, but they've admitted that they spent a bunch of money on mansions and maybe shouldn't have. In fact, that one of the BLM co-founders said that there were mistakes, she admitted at one point, in spending some of the $90 million that was raised, and she called it white guilt money. Okay. See, so if you're a white person who donated to the movement, and now she's saying, oh, this is white guilt money. I mean, some of it probably was white guilt money, but that's how she characterizes it. That's ridiculous. So anyway, I look forward to watching the rest of this documentary from Candace Owens with my, you know, eyes and ears wide open to learn something or to be offended by it. I don't know. But the first half hour really to me is just non-controversial. I mean, it's just painting a clearer picture of things and not cherry picking what facts and circumstances to relay to the public, which I actually really appreciate. I had several of you send me a recent report card out from the Cato Institute, which is kind of a libertarian think tank, but they're focused on good, sound fiscal policy, limited government. And they always put out this scorecard for the nation's governors. And this is their criteria. So it's the fiscal policy report card on America's governors 2022. And their criteria is this. This report grades governors on their fiscal policies from a limited government perspective. Governors receiving an A are those who have cut taxes and spending the most, whereas governors receiving an F have increased taxes and spending the most. And I know what you'll think going into this, that, okay, it's a libertarian think tank that's focused on limited government. Clearly, all the Democratic governors are going to have Fs and all the Republican governors are going to have As. And that is not the case. In fact, when you look at the list, you have some Democrats who are toward the top of the list. Governor Roy Cooper in North Carolina is 6th on the list for best. He has a B rating. There's not very many. Only 5 governors have an A grade. Iowa, New Hampshire, Nebraska, Idaho, and Arizona. But then it's Roy Cooper, a Democrat from North Carolina. Also, the Democratic governors of New Mexico and Louisiana and Wisconsin and Nevada, they fare fine in the report. And then you go down all the way to the bottom to the F grades, the lowest 3. That's not a surprise at all. It's hilarious to me. Oh, the West Coast, Oregon, California, and Washington. So obviously those are all Democratic governors, and it's like this little West Coast, they have like a pact where they all kind of do things together. So Kate Brown, the Democratic governor of Oregon, F. Gavin Newsom, the Democratic governor of California, F. Jay Inslee, the Democratic governor of Washington, F. And he also has the lowest rating of a 28. California and Oregon have a 29. I believe it's out of 100. And so he is not only, you know, it's not like it's tied for the last. He is the last. So what are the kind of differences here? So let me share for you Cato's reasoning for its highest rated governor, which is Governor Kim Reynolds of Iowa. It says she has been a lean budgeter and a dedicated tax reformer since entering office in 2017. She receives the highest score on this report. Iowa general fund spending has risen just 2.3% annual average rate under Reynolds. In 2018, she signed into law corporate and individual income tax cuts. In 2021, she abolished Iowa's inheritance tax. In 2022, she approved a tax overhaul that simplifies and lowers Iowa's individual income tax structure, et cetera, et cetera. So let's see why Governor Jay Inslee fared so poorly. So I should note that Cato has given Governor Inslee an F multiple times. He got an F in 2014, an F in 2016, an F in 2018, and an F in 2020. And he now has the lowest score in the nation. They say he has a large appetite for tax and spending increases. Under Inslee, general fund spending expanded at an annual average rate of 6.3% between 2013 and 2020. And they also note that Governor Jay Inslee came into office by promising, what did he promise? Not to approve any new taxes. They say when Inslee originally ran for the governor's office, he promised not to raise taxes, but in his first budget, he proposed more than $1 billion in hikes. Since then, he has proposed or approved a myriad of new and increased taxes on energy, capital gains, tobacco, businesses, real estate transaction, and online sales. And so this, again, is not a surprise, but one of the things I appreciate that they pointed out is that Washington State residents, despite this being a blue state and having a big progressive core in Seattle, Washington State residents have repeatedly rejected taxes at the ballot box. And then you have the governor who's like, don't care. I don't care what people want. And so they note all the times that constitutional amendments to allow for an income tax, because an income tax that's not like an equal income tax, like so if everybody's taxed at 3%, et cetera. So graduated income tax is against our Constitution. And so they noted that in 1934, 1936, 1938, 1942, 1944, 1970, 73, 75, 82, 2010, voters here have voted against having constitutional amendments to allow for an income tax. And then they've also approved some advisory votes, which are basically just saying, hey, we know we have no say over this, but we want you to know that we do not agree with this tax increase that you have passed. So, yeah, I had a lot of people emailing me this. This is not a surprise to me. And I just wonder, you know, here's my thing on the limited government sort of sentiment. I don't understand what's controversial about it. What is controversial about expecting that if the government takes money from you, it needs that money, one, and it's using that money, it's spending that money well and efficiently? What's controversial about wanting a government to be able to cut fat and let you keep more of your own money? You know, that sentiment, I'm not saying that you cut the government so small that it can't perform basic functions. But clearly there are other states that are getting by just fine without the level of spending that Washington State has. And again, the whole West Coast, all the governors on the West Coast have Fs. So I just think this is something that should be a little more non-controversial to say, yeah, we want a limited government in the sense that, one, we don't want the government to interfere in our lives. And I think that's a sentiment that people on the right and the left have. I mean, look at the abortion debate right now. Do you really want the government interfering in your personal medical decisions? And then on the right, you know, I think there's a lot of, I mean, certainly libertarians are the most consistent on limited government intervention. But, you know, when it comes to spending, conservatives have always believed in limited government. And so I just wish that more people would really demand that the government is accountable for the money it spends and only takes what it needs from the citizens. Again, it seems very non-controversial to me. So, Governor Jay Inslee, congratulations on your failing grade. The same to you, Governor Brown in Oregon and Governor Newsom in California. This message is brought to you by Washington's Emergency Management Division. I was joking around last week on the podcast with my sister from Florida because we just had Hurricane Ian, which was obviously very serious, but she is, as you might find out shortly, visiting Washington State. And I was making sure that, you know, she's used to hurricanes. I was making sure that she would be ready in case we have the big one, the big earthquake, which I'm just expecting any day, hoping it doesn't happen, but you have to be realistic. And, you know, it got me thinking about that. So I was giving her some tips and tricks on earthquake preparedness, because last time I had a family member in town, my sister-in-law, I kind of was awoken in the middle of the night and I didn't really know what it was, but the dogs were standing up by the bed and my sister-in-law was in the other room and I just kind of picked up my phone. I looked that she had messaged me and she's like, "Your house is shaking." And I got up and I opened the door and she's across the hall just standing there, totally freaked out. And we had had a minor earthquake. And so I was like, you know what? I need to make sure my family members, before they come to visit, know what to do in the event of an earthquake in case it happens here. And I've been telling you guys on the podcast that the Great Washington Shakeout is coming up on October 20th. And this is a really great opportunity for you to work with your friends and your family and your children just to say, okay, hey, let's practice what we would do in the event of an earthquake and to go over sort of how you'd react if it was at home, if it happened when they were at school, if you were in a high rise at your office building, and kind of go through the scenarios and have a plan in place. You can find all of these tips at shakeout.org/Washington. And if you're participating, make sure to use the hashtag shakeout on social media. But at the very least, make sure you talk to your family and friends about what you would do in the event of an earthquake, and then join the Great Washington Shakeout at 10:20 a.m. local time on October 20th, where you will drop, cover, and hold along with millions of other people so that we are as prepared as we can be for a major earthquake. This message is brought to you by Washington's Emergency Management Division. The other day on the podcast, we were talking about, I mean, we talk about crime on the podcast all the time because I just think it's such a disastrous state right now. But my friend Dave Ross, who I used to work with him at Cairo News Radio in Seattle, he's a longtime legendary radio host in Seattle, even made a brief foray, he ran for politics once. He had a commentary on crime that I didn't necessarily agree with. I'll play a portion of that for you.
Seattle's per capita murder rate isn't even in the top 10 or the top 20 or the top 50. It's 77th, 3.74 killings per 100,000 people each year, about the same as Portland or Riverside, California, or surprisingly, New York City. Atlanta's murder rate is four times that today. So I'm still glad we moved here. So why does it feel like crime is out of control? Because there's a political campaign on. A lot of the ads are focused on crime, and fear works.
So I invited Dave Ross to come on the show for Fridays with Friends to talk about what's going on with crime in this country and in cities like Seattle, but also just to talk a little bit about his just amazing career in talk radio. The Dave Ross, welcome to Fridays with Friends.
Thank you.
It has been a long time since I've seen you in person, although I listen to the show still. How many years have you been at Cairo News Radio now?
44.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 44. I had the same reaction when I found out.
Have you put thought into how much longer?
Yes, I have put thought into how much longer. Some years ago, I started a file folder which has the tab Life After Radio, and it's empty. So that's what's kept me working for so long. I can't figure out anything more interesting than what I'm doing.
Well, I heard a rumor about you, and I want to know if it's a true rumor. Do you park at the top of the stairs by the studio still?
Before my heart surgery, yes, I did. Since then, they've given me a parking space across the street from the station. But for years, I've, like anybody in Seattle, I've been in search of free parking. And we're right next to I-5, and there's that Colonnade Park under the freeway, and behind that, on, I think it's Lakeview Avenue, is this undiscovered strip of the city hasn't discovered there's free parking there yet, is all I can figure. And since I get there at 4:30 in the morning, it's always empty. So I parked up there for years until others found out about it. But no, since then, they have finally given me a spot across the street. So,
see, what I heard, and maybe it's not true, is that because these stairs are, I mean, it has to be 200 stairs?
No, 116 steps.
116. What I heard is that you parked up there because the day you couldn't walk back to your car, you were going to quit your radio job. Is there any truth to that?
That's actually not a bad way to do it. No, sometimes I will. I would walk up the stairs, and sometimes I walk up the second flight, which takes all the way up to Capitol Hill, mostly for exercise. So I've learned that the only way I can do exercise, because I find it so boring, is to force myself to do it. So number one, it was free parking, and number two, it forced me to walk 116 steps 5 days a week, and here I am.
Yeah, I mean, you're in great shape, so maybe 116 stairs a day isn't a bad idea.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've really, and I was talking about, I filled in for Dory Monson the other day, and I was talking about, I was telling people that they shouldn't just listen to Dory's show if they only listen to his show, because one of the things that I like about Cairo News Radio is you can listen at different times of the day and get just totally different opinions. But I compared you on the air the other day to Bill Maher, and I want to know if you're offended by this or if you think it's fair. So my argument is, and why I listen to your show, even though we disagree on some stuff politically, is because I feel like you're always willing to call balls and strikes, even if it's against, you know, the political side you might more closely associate with. And I feel like Bill Maher has been good at that lately. So what's your approach, I guess, on the show to trying to deal with the political climate that we're in?
Yeah, well, first of all, Bill Maher swears. I do not swear. On the political climate, I have, throughout my career, wanted to find solutions to things. I admit that it's fun to debate sometimes, but most debates go in circles and it changes nobody's mind. And more importantly, nothing changes on the ground. So when I decide to do a commentary on an issue, usually it's focused on trying to solve the problem. What I've learned over the years is that many times it's not in a politician's interest to solve the problem, because once you do that, what do you fundraise on, right? It takes fear to raise money, and nobody votes for a guy who says, vote for me, I'll represent you, and I'm nice. No, it's vote for me, because if you vote for the other guy, America will fall into the sea. So there's just no motivation for actually solving the problems. That's what my approach has been. I will tell you, it's a difficult approach to market in the commercial environment of talk radio, because again, it doesn't have the same kind of excitement and thrill of stomping your opponent. But that's what makes the job fun to me. And that's what's kept me going for 44 years, is because the job is fun. Otherwise, I'd have been gone long ago.
You're talking about your empty folder saying life after radio, you know, some people will remember that you ran for Congress in 2004. Have you contemplated politics at all?
No. No, I'm too old to run now. If I were elected to Congress now, I would never get any seniority, and I'd just be, you know, watching other people have all the fun. But it was an excellent experience, because it helped me be a little more sympathetic towards politicians than I had been before.
How so?
Well, because I understand why they censor themselves. I understand why they never say anything. The politicians who talk the most in public are the ones, in my experience, who get the least done. You have guys like, I guess Sherrod Brown was one that I thought was a workhorse and not a show horse. They work in the background. They're focused on solutions. There are a number of, what is it called? The Problem Solvers Caucus? I forget what they're calling themselves these days. It's a bipartisan
group. I think it is the Problem Solvers Caucus still.
Yeah, who are mostly people you've never heard of, and they apparently get together, and they leave it to the other guys to, you know, push the Democratic and Republican brands in public while they're in the back room slaving away at language that will actually solve the problem. And I guess crossing their fingers they can still get reelected. But, you know, that was the group of people that I would probably have affiliated myself with. Whether that would have gotten me reelected, I don't know. What I do know is that they warned me that if you win, the next day we'll be having you making 5 hours of fundraising calls each afternoon. So, I don't know. I guess losing might have been not as bad as I felt at the time.
Well, it was a different political climate back then. I mean, in so many ways, but even the 8th Congressional District was more firmly in Republican hands, and that's changed a little bit over the years, obviously. You ran as a Democrat. Do you still consider yourself a member of the Democratic Party?
Well, I never signed up to be a member of the Democratic Party, so I'm definitely more in sympathy with Democrats these days, only because of the quality of the people running. A lot of people, anytime a Republican allies themselves with Donald Trump, it discredits them because I believe he betrayed the country. I could say more, but I won't.
Well, I mean, that's what I believe too. So you can say all you want about that. I've been very clear. And it's interesting you talked about it's hard to market when you're not firmly in one camp. And, you know, even in Seattle, although I might fall towards the right in Seattle, you know, I still consider myself a moderate independent. And I've been very harsh on the former president. And there'll be times where I'll do a segment and lose hundreds of subscribers that day over a Donald Trump
segment.
You're
in a really difficult environment because, even though... If I say something that people hate, it doesn't affect my salary. And you're out there in the Wild West, Brandy.
Yeah, it's fun, though. And you just have to commit yourself to it and realize that, you know, and I told people when we launched the podcast, you're going to hate what I say half the time. And you've got to be able to live with that. It's just not going to be the podcast for you. Speaking of, you know, I'm going to agree with people half the time. You had a couple commentaries lately that I've had strong opinions on. One of them was the hire back ferry workers who were fired over the vaccine mandate.
Yeah.
Now, is that just because you rely on the ferries in the selfish position?
I find most of my commentaries, you got to write what you know, right? So I take the ferries a lot because I have a hideaway on Vashon Island. So about once a week, you'll find me on a ferry somewhere. And I've gotten to know a few ferry workers over the years. They're great people. I know it can be a mind-numbing job sometimes, but they're also essential. I mean, it's required by the Coast Guard for safety reasons. And I didn't understand the reason why, especially when we were having staff shortages like this, you would fire perfectly healthy people because they felt they could stay healthy without taking the vaccine. Made no sense to me, especially now. I mean, I cut Jay Inslee, the politician, some slack because in the early days, this was the illness from hell. It was a mystery illness. Nobody knew how to fight it. And the best medical experts I could talk to, and I talked to a doctor every week for our show, is that there's no vaccination against coronaviruses. Absolutely unheard of. But now we managed to come up with one. I haven't had a cold now, not even a regular, ordinary cold in 2.5 years, which is really weird. So, I mean, it looks like we actually licked that. Back then, they didn't know that. Well, now that we've fixed it, I don't understand why you wouldn't say, okay, that was what we thought at the time, that we had to be really hard-nosed about vaccination. But now you have staff shortages, you have runs being canceled, the schedule cut back, and at the same time, experienced people out there who could fill those jobs. Why not just say, okay, you know, we're sorry. Please come back. You're already trained. Come back.
Why do you think that the governor has not been willing to go that far, or his agencies?
I guess he's worried that a bunch of Republicans would say, I told you so. And they would, but so what? Again, it's about solving the problem, right? So if they say, told you so, that's life.
Yeah, and I'd feel much differently. I mean, I got vaccinated, but when I, you know, still got COVID, I was like, I'm not going to get boosted. At least I haven't yet. And I would feel much differently about the vaccine mandate if it was highly effective in stopping transmission. I do realize that, you know, it can keep you from dying, but I would have felt much differently about it. But when we realized you could still get and give it, I was sort of like, okay, maybe we don't fire cops and firefighters and ferry workers. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense. You said you gave Governor Inslee leeway at the beginning, and I did too. I was sort of like, let's just do what needs to be done. I think it was this really unknown situation. What do you think of the governor's, you know, kind of lengthy emergency powers, which are, he's giving it up in like 16 days. Does that bother you, the fact that he's kept his state of emergency going?
I've listened to some of the commentary on that he's trying to be a dictator. I think that's ridiculous. I think part of the emergency power thing is apparently a formality to allow them to move money around. I was happy that they avoided a recession, although we're apparently going to pay for it next year. Now, it's the fact of a governor declaring emergency powers itself doesn't bother me. Firing people who didn't need to be fired is what bothers me more than that. You should have the right not to get vaccinated if you don't want to. And it's also true that we were slow to realize that it wasn't the disease wasn't as dangerous to children as we thought in the beginning. But again, being a grandparent and knowing how my daughter feels about her young child, she's going to get that kid vaccinated because you don't want to. Even if it's like a 2% chance of a kid dying from COVID, no parent wants to take that chance. Those are precious lives. So basically, yeah, I believe give people a choice. I think if you compare us to other states, we were pretty successful at avoiding some of the worst case scenarios that were being predicted for COVID. But now that it seems to be under control, like I say, it's time to move on. Vaccine amnesty, hire them back. Get some of the cops back too, for God's sake.
My argument against, what the governor was doing in this sort of unilateral power wasn't really about Jay Inslee per se. It was like, why don't we have the legislature be able to sign off on a continued state of emergency?
It becomes inevitably political, as it did. I mean, the whole debate over emergency powers is political. It's over the oppressive Jay Inslee, which I just think is ridiculous.
Well, you got Democrats in control, though, so presumably they'd just sign off on it anyway.
Well, I guess, but I don't think you make policy because of and hope that the status quo is going to stay there forever. I mean, things will switch, and we know that these emergencies are used for political purposes. And I admit that's putting a lot of trust in one man, but let's remember, and I hate to go back to the founders, but they realize that somebody's got to be in charge. There's got to be an executive.
Let's talk about crime, because you did another commentary that I half agreed with, and then for half of it I was screaming at the radio, and then I agreed with you again at the end. But just generally speaking, like you said, you've been in Seattle for a long time, and in the commentary you talked about living in Atlanta, for instance. Characterize the state of Seattle, in your opinion. Give us your honest assessment from a public safety standpoint.
I feel safe going into downtown Seattle in the daytime. I feel safe going to Seattle Center at night. I'll be going there tonight to a show. I would not go to a bar and stay until 2 a.m. But I'll tell you, Brandon, that's not because of the current situation. I've never gone to a bar and stayed until 2 a.m. Nothing good. What do my parents say? Nothing good ever happens after midnight out in public. But I also have, I go to the Pike Place Market area like three times a week. That's where my gym is. And sometimes I'll wander up to 3rd and 4th Avenue to check it out. And it's depressing compared to what it was. But I had to put that in perspective, not just because of my experience in Atlanta, where, as I mentioned, the commentary, I was a police reporter, was, for a year or so, we went out at every murder. But I also remember what Seattle looked like when I first got here in 1978. I used to take the, I couldn't afford a parking space or, to drive downtown. So I took the bus and I got off at Westlake. Westlake was, for the center of a city, it was the most depressing looking city center I had ever seen. I walked to work to the old Cairo building, either along 3rd or 4th Avenues. Back in the day, 4th Avenue between downtown and the Seattle Center was a wasteland of aging, decrepit buildings, flop houses, et cetera, et cetera. The places where people who now live in tents would have lived before, right? And you were accosted by panhandlers. The whole was about a mile walk, and I would keep little dollar bills in my pocket. So I'd say, here for you, here for you, here for you, as I passed the panhandlers. So that was Seattle State back then. There were people hanging around the missions in Pioneer Square, et cetera, et cetera. Seattle is vastly, vastly improved since then. It's got a real downtown. It can compete with any other big city in America. And at its height, right before the pandemic, I would walk past the Amazon building. They had food trucks out there. They were making yogurt for the employees. Everybody was, eating outside. It was great. The pandemic killed that. And talking to the Downtown Seattle Association, occupancy downtown is like 40%. That's why it looks so morose, because you find when the office workers are down there, when the cruise ships are in town, there are still homeless people there. There's always going to be homeless people there, no matter what you do. That's just the way societies work. But it feels a lot better when you're surrounded by, you know, 80% of the people who look like you and have a place to go and have jobs, and you don't feel insecure. On a gloomy day when there are no cruise ships in town and you've only got 40% occupancy and nobody's outside, who's going to still be out there? The people who have no place else to go. And then you assume all of Seattle has no place to go. No, not true. It's a vibrant city. I'm lucky to have moved here. And it just discourages me that so many people are down on it.
Yeah, and the kind of closing point you make is we can't abandon downtown, because if we abandon downtown, then, you know, it's taken over by the ne'er-do-wells or whatever. And I agree with that sentiment. You know, I was just downtown the other day. I mean, I'm willing to go downtown, but I think one of the issues I take, and it's actually, I did a commentary a couple of years ago admonishing former Chief Carmen Best and former Mayor Jenny Durkan for this. We just had that shooting down at the McDonald's where some innocent people,
yeah,
including
right.
a little boy, were shot. And they have this press conference and they come out and say, well, actually, you know, crime numbers are down from their peak, like in the 90s or whatever. And it's like, well, we don't care what our crime numbers are.
Exactly.
We want to know what you're doing. And so when people point to the 80s or the 90s, it's like, I wasn't even alive, you know, and I certainly wasn't in Seattle. And then when people say, well, crime is not bad in Seattle compared to the murder rate in Atlanta or Chicago, it's like, well, I don't live in Atlanta or Chicago. I live in Seattle, and all I've known is Seattle for the past 13 years, and it's been on this steady decline. And so isn't it okay to, regardless of the numbers, to want to feel safe in the city that you're at, relatively speaking?
Yeah, I generally don't like using statistics, because like you say, statistics don't apply to your own case. And of course, if you're the victim of assault, the crime rate might as well be 100% for you, right? All I know is that the antidote to crime is creating a feeling of security. And so there's a number of ways to do that. More cops on the beat. One thing I like about New York City, and I grew up in the suburbs of New York and was going with my dad a number of times. And, you know, he teaches you, if you're traveling, always stand with your suitcase between your legs. Keep your wallet in a zipper pocket. Don't go down dark streets. I mean, that's just the way you behave in a big city. You can put cops on the streets. And that's what New York does. You walk down a street in New York, there's always a cop somewhere in view. Should be the same in downtown Seattle. At walking, I mean, bikes are nice, I guess. Cars, I don't feel secure because a cop car drives by. I want to see a cop walking up and down the street. And the second is putting on public events. That's what the Downtown Seattle Association does. We used to have concerts. I once conducted the Seattle Symphony at Freeway Park. You know, you have events that draw people out and get a lot of working people walking around. It's good exercise for them, and it makes everybody feel safe. And that's what they've got to do. And I think that's what the DSA is trying to do with their ambassador program. Also, you keep it clean. You paint over the graffiti. And this is a thing that really bugs me. I've never liked that retaining wall along I-5. It's like a scar through Seattle. But it's even worse when it's covered with graffiti. But trying to get them to put artificial ivy on it, because the graffiti artists hate walls with ivy. They won't touch them. And if you're not going to do that, then go out there with a giant spray paint truck every night and spray over it until the graffiti artists are so frustrated they give up and find something productive to do with their evening.
Yeah, I do agree with the graffiti sentiment, the trash sentiment. So what would your advice be to, say, Amazon? Amazon could make a huge difference if it opted to have all of its employees come back and revitalize downtown. But then I look at some of the things that have happened. You know, they had the Amazon engineer who was her head bashed in with a baseball bat by a random guy. You had the just the other day, the rideshare driver shot in the back of the head outside the Spheres. And so I know from Amazon's perspective, there's been a hesitancy given the state of things. But it's sort of like, if you bring your workers back, things would get better, but you're worried to bring your workers back. So I guess if you had Amazon's ear, what would your advice be to them?
Well, I would say figure out what it takes. You got some dough there at Amazon. Figure out what it takes to make workers feel secure. I mean, hire your own security people. I mean, if you choose, you're in the news business, you know, any given day, we have the resources to broadcast every crime in America and scare the hell out of the people. There are some really nasty characters out there. But you go back in history and, you know, we've had axe murderers, we've had serial killers. Yeah, we are mortal human beings, and we still have those animal instincts. And some people have things wrong with their brain that makes them do brutal things. That's all terrible, and they should be punished if we can't figure out a way to reprogram their brains. But you don't. We're Americans, Brandy. We don't surrender, and that's what I'm worried that people have decided to surrender, and now that they, a lot of them can work from home. There's no reason ever to leave the house. I just think that's a boring way to live. I don't want, I mean, it was, I worked from home. I worked from this room for 2.5 years. And it was great in the beginning because I could just walk downstairs and go to work. But I'm talking to little figures in a screen. That's just no way to live. It's so much better to get back into the office and be with Chris and Colleen and the crew and feel like you're part of a team. Instead of phoning in from your hideaway.
Yeah. I know I've kept you just way too long, so I'll wrap up by saying and yeah, I mean I agree that I hope people can bring themselves to keep the city alive, but I can't tell anybody like disregard your safety if you don't feel
Of course
safe.
not. If you
That's a
don't feel
decision you
safe,
have to
stay
make,
home. But
right?
I'm saying, give it a chance. There were people sitting at home in Florida who ended up drowning. I mean, they're Life is full of risks. If you look at what kills people, it's bathtubs and stairs, and those are right there in your home.
Yeah. We'll end with this. What's going to happen in November? November 8th, what party is going to control Congress?
No idea, and I don't care. I just hope that the votes are not overturned by somebody. I just hope that we trust the count, that it's all secure, that we all agree that it's a secure election. I frankly, Brandy, I'm so worried about the election process itself. As long as it results in a decision accepted by everybody, then I have no problem with who controls Congress.
As I mentioned a couple minutes ago, it is Friday. That's when we do our segment Florida Report. We check in on what's happening in the state of Florida, and we bring on my sister virtually from Florida to update us on things. Well, I have a little surprise for you.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
In studio, for the first time ever. Is my sister Miranda? You've never been here.
I have never been
I
here.
mean, you've been like here, but not in the studio.
Yeah, I've been to Seattle many times, but never to the undivided studios.
Wow, what a blessing. Hashtag blessed. You had quite an adventure to get here yesterday.
Yes.
It was so funny because you're technically here like working, doing stuff for the podcast. And so we had got your flight booked and stuff, and then you were supposed to go to where? North Carolina?
Yeah, I couldn't find a direct flight out with good time, so I was going to have a connection in North Carolina.
Yeah, and then they didn't take off, and so then missed your connecting flight to Seattle, and then they put you got off the plane,
Yes.
and then they put you on a direct flight, and you got in at like 2 a.m.
Yeah, I got in at 2 a.m. and my luggage still isn't here, so that'll be fun to
Yeah.
track it down later
So
today.
I found a bunch of stuff in my closet that I've gotten too fat for. And I was like, brought her all the stuff that used to fit me. And I was like, here's what I have. That, like the stuff you keep in your closet that you hope one day fits you again, that's the stuff I packed for her because we're staying in Bellevue tonight. So I was like, here's my skinny clothes. You can have them. Yeah, the airports, it's funny though, because the airports are a disaster. So she was like on the tarmac and she's like, can you try to get me a different flight because I don't have like really good service. And I was like, great, this is gonna be a disaster because it was American. And I'm like, ugh. They were so nice. I felt bad because and I had booked you a hotel overnight in Charlotte because I thought you were gonna get stuck there. So like I had the best customer service experiences with American, which was a shock, with Expedia, which I always have pretty good customer service with them. Then who else did I have to call? Oh, with the hotel itself. They're like, oh yeah, we'll take care of it, no problem. I'm like, you guys have been so nice.
Look, sometimes things just align. Like my flights didn't line up, but at least people were kind about it. And I think that takes a lot of the stress and edge off, you know.
Well, and then there was a mass shooting in North Carolina where you would have had to stay. And I was like, maybe that was just serendipity. Is that the phrase that's best for that?
Serendipus, yes.
Yeah. We're very smart. Before we got started, we're like, wow, we have nice hair. It's good. If you're listening to the podcast, you can't see our nice hair. So you should watch the
So
podcast.
you can see it.
Okay, we got to get serious for a second.
Yeah.
because the Parkland trial has finally come to an end, the sentencing phase of the shooter at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. And it just feels like these things drag on so long, because it's been how many years since
this happened? Valentine's Day 2018. So yeah, it's been a while.
Almost 4 years, yeah.
I'm not sure how much the pandemic played into slowing down that trial at all.
That's true.
That could definitely be a reason why it did take so long to get here.
So ultimately, the jury did not sentence him to death.
No.
Which I know is kind of a controversial thing. And in Florida, you know, in our state, our death penalty has not been used for a long time. So it doesn't even make sense at this point to even have it as an option. Yeah. But in Florida, that's not the case.
That's not the case.
So what was the split of the jury?
From what I have read, there's three jurors that did not go for death penalty. Mm-hmm. So that puts him life in prison without possibility of parole, which, you know, I think death penalty is always a very arguable thing. I think mm-hmm. there's a lot of people that are always split on that, no matter what state you're in. But from a lot of the videos and the footage and the statements that I've seen of families, the families don't seem to be too happy with that and don't really consider it to be real true justice that he gets to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Yeah, and I know, and having covered crime and justice for a big chunk of my career, there's always a split among victims, because some of them want them to suffer every day in prison and have every day thinking about what they've done, and the other ones just want them gone. But to me, it always comes down to how quickly the death penalty is going to be carried out, because the death penalty, I think, can serve to draw things out, where it's constantly appeals, bringing victims' families back to court. And it's like, that can be hard for some families.
It can. I mean, you're looking at years and years of appeals and just all the standard stuff that actually just happens when you are on death row, just making sure that they've given you the proper sentence and everything. Yeah. You're right. I think it just can drag things out for a very long time, and keep it as like a constant conversation at the top of the pile rather than just letting him go out of sight, out of mind for life and, you know, for life in prison and that's it.
Yeah.
So it's sad. It's really like tough. The trial was really difficult to, you know, watch some of it and hear people's opinions on it, because it is very close to Miami. It's like about 30 minutes north of Miami. I have a lot of friends that grew up in Boca that were very familiar with the school, and you know, you listen to some of the jury talking about how they did a walkthrough of the school, because they did keep the school completely locked down and exactly as it was from the day that this happened. And I can't imagine what it was like to walk through those hallways and those classrooms and see the carnage left behind from that day.
And I hadn't heard that until you told me. So they left, for the most part, the scene as was, like almost like they locked the doors and like, you know, whatever was left. And you said it happened on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
So some of these jurors' notes talks about like deflated Valentine's Day balloons, you know, dead flowers, and then blood strewn everywhere, and like kids just leaving. One described it as like it just was sort of a normal.
Yeah, like as if these kids were just having an absolutely normal day at school, and it was disrupted in the worst kind of way, and the school was left in that moment.
Yeah, like laptops sitting open.
Yeah.
And you said cans of soda that were open but like turned to sludge because they had been there for so long.
Yeah. There's a few jury notes that were released for the public to read, and they're really difficult to read. And so I can't imagine physically seeing that.
Yeah, it takes a brave person to commit to jury duty. You know, I know there's a lot of people who go there and they try to do what they can to get out of it. And I mean, if you go in there and you sit and you know that this is the trial that they want you for, I mean, that changes your life forever. The things you saw, like seeing, you know, these years-old blood stains everywhere. And I mean, especially if you're a parent sitting on the jury, I can't even imagine.
I really can't imagine. And just like carrying that emotional toll of that trial for the rest of your life regardless has got to be very difficult for the jurors. And they have to live like a very like quiet kind of life after trials, you know. And I don't know. I just hope everybody involved in the situation gets, you know, help and whatever they might need to move forward, even if this guy just sits in prison for the rest of his life. There's a lot of healing that still happens, even after the trial, maybe even more so.
Yeah. And hopefully the media will leave the jurors alone, because I know that after the Derek Chauvin trial in the murder of George Floyd, remember, there was some media who were like following the jury bus, and it's like, If their names get out there without them deciding, because I know a lot of like high profile trials, jurors will come forward and they'll want to talk about it and what they went through. But if your name gets out there without you wanting it to, it can change your life forever, especially if you're somebody who voted like against the death penalty. Because you said there's one juror who apparently went to like a courtroom staffer after and said, we don't know who the jury is, we don't know if they wanted the death penalty or not, but said they were...
they were threatened by another juror.
That's what their claim is.
They're claiming that another juror during deliberations actually threatened them. And like you said, we don't know who stood where and what the threat was about, but I wonder if that will have much of a, like, create any problems or changes for the actual, you know, decision that they made.
Right, if they'll have to go back through, if they find that to be true, if they have to go back through the sentencing phase
of the trial. Yeah, re-deliberate.
So, and that's hard for families as well, or if there'd be a different outcome. So, all right, well, that's a sad one, but I mean, like, you know, it's got to happen for the families, and I can't even imagine.
Yeah, so. I hope it brings a little bit of closure. I know for the whole state was kind of, you know, when this trial started, was just ready for it to be over and kind of close this chapter as much as possible so that the families can just begin to heal. And I wonder what they'll do with the school now that the trial's over. I'm assuming they will level it.
Knock it down.
And, you know, do a memorial or something for those kids. But
Well, Miranda, thank you. It's nice to have you here.
It is nice to be in the studio. It's very nice and cozy. I like it.
you were commenting on the number of American flags I have in here, which, of course, you know, I love our country.
There's a lot of flags in here. I love it.
But also, on a like a serious note, it's our 100th episode on Monday, which is very exciting. And I was telling people we have a special guest. But I'm so grateful for everything you've done to support this effort behind the scenes, because like you were there from the beginning, like, I'm gonna quit my job, and you were like helping, you were working on the show, you were attending meetings with the Patreon people with me, and so I appreciate you.
Oh,
hug from my sister. Thank you for supporting
me. I'm very proud of you. I love the whole concept, the movement, giving Common Sense a comeback. I'm really proud that my sister is the one helping do that, because
the only one. I'm doing it alone.
She's the only one. No, I've it's been really fun being a part of it, and even like getting to know a few of your like subscribers and followers from me being part of the podcast has been really cool. So I look forward to another 100 episodes.
I know, another 100 plus some. All right, that has been today's edition, special edition of Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Okay, every Friday we end the show with our segment Understanding America, where we look back at, you know, laws or speeches that have shaped this wonderful country of ours. And I was like, I have the perfect one for today. So the Seattle Mariners are making their unlikely playoff debut, like their first time in the playoffs in what, like 20 years or something crazy like that. And so everybody's really excited, although, you know, they're down to the Astros in the series right now. But so I was going back to my trusty book on American documents and such. And there was this one I had kept seeing, but I'm like, why would I read that? But it's perfect for now. It's the Rules and Regulations of the Knickerbocker Baseball Club, written in 1845. So throughout the 19th century, baseball was popular. I mean, people just kind of played it as a pastime. But in 1845, a bank clerk named Alexander Cartwright Jr. formed an actual club called the Knickerbocker Baseball Club. And this is the first time they formally kind of put the rules into place. They would play regularly in Hoboken, New Jersey. So it has a list of all these. There's, gosh, how many rules are there? 20 rules to this Knickerbocker Baseball Club. But this is what sort of led to kind of the more formal rules and baseball as America's pastime. So I want to read first just their intro to the rules, and I'll read a couple of the rules for you too. For many years, the games of town ball, rounders, and old cat have been the sport of young boys. Recently, they have, in one form or another, been much enjoyed by gentlemen seeking wholesome American exercise. In 1845, Alexander Cartwright and other members of the Knickerbocker Baseball Club of New York codified the unwritten rules of these boys' game into one, and so made the game of baseball a sport worthy of attention by adults. We have little doubt but that this gentlemanly pastime will capture the interest and imagination of sportsmen and spectator alike throughout this country. Herewith are offered the first and complete rules of the game of baseball, as played by the Knickerbocker Baseball Club. Rule number one, Member must strictly observe the time agreed upon for exercise and be punctual in their attendance. Always a good rule number one, making sure people are on time. Key. Rule number two, when assembled for exercise, the president, or in his absence, the vice president, shall appoint an umpire, who shall keep the game in a book provided for that purpose and note violations of the bylaws and rules during the time of exercise. Rule number three, the presiding officer shall designate two members as captains who shall retire and make the match to be played, observing at the same time that the players put opposite to each other should be nearly as equal as possible, the choice of sides to be then tossed for, and the first in hand to be decided in like manner. So, very fancy way of saying they're deciding who bats first. The fourth rule, the bases shall be from home to second base, 42 paces. From first to third base, 42 paces equidistant. Anyway, I thought this was fun. I didn't really know about this sort of history and Mr. Cartwright Jr. and his friends and the Knickerbocker Baseball Club. So with that, best of luck to the Mariners as they go on to Game 3. They're down 2-0 to the Astros in the series, but it's been exciting to see them in the playoffs nonetheless. And that is it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. I will see all of you on Monday, which is our 100th episode of Undivided, which I cannot believe it's 100 already. I've got a special guest for you on Monday that I think you will really, really love to ring in the occasion. If you've not become an Undivided subscriber already, now is a great time to do so. You can do that at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.